Everybody, this is your host of Film Wax, Adam Chartoff here. This is episode number 796. It is Friday, March 1st, 2024. A good March 1st to you. We have a great episode. I just want to first shout out a thank you to my producers at Radio Free Rhinecliff and to the community at Radio Free Rhinecliff, Jen Hamoud and Matt Mercier and Maddie Rosenberg, and everybody, all the hosts, all the guests and listeners, and everybody involved in Radio Free Rhinecliff. It's a great thing. It's a great way to premiere every episode of the podcast. At 6 o'clock, you can go to RadioFreeRhinecliff.org and stream the show live at 6 o'clock on Friday evenings. And then right after that, the show is available on all the apps. So in this episode, we are talking to Mario Van Peebles, the actor, the filmmaker, and his son, who's also an actor, Mandela Van Peebles. Mario is the son of Melvin Van Peebles, and Mandela, of course, the grandson. And for years when I was doing this podcast, I was always trying to get to Melvin to get him on the show, because he's in the Mount Rushmore of independent filmmakers, and somebody who I feel like it's because of filmmakers like Melvin Van Peebles that I ended up doing the podcast, because I just love that whole tradition of the outsider filmmaker, and independent film and art house film and all that. Melvin died back in 2021, so I was not able ever to get him on the show. But when I had the opportunity to invite Mario Van Peebles and Mandela Van Peebles, I took that opportunity, and we had a great time talking about a new movie that the two are involved with. In fact, Mario is the director and the film star, and it's called Outlaw Posse. It is out in theaters today around the country, and they are my guests. I will also be including afterwards in another segment, I am pulling from the archives a conversation I had with Walter Hill, the director of such movies as The Warriors, 48 Hours, The Driver, because I'm trying to start to really tap into this incredible archive that I do have and put it back out there in the world. So you'll have this brand new conversation with the Van Peebles about this movie, Outlaw Posse. The film also, by the way, it takes place in 1908 when Chief, played by Mario Van Peebles, returns from years of hiding in Mexico to claim stolen gold hidden in the hills of Montana. In his quest, he reunites an ensemble of fresh and familiar faces. Together, they fight off Angel, whose rationale to get to the gold leaves a trail of deception and dead bodies. And I should mention, in addition to Cedric the Entertainer and Whoopi Goldberg, two former Film Wax guests, William Apother and John Carroll Lynch, are both in this film as well. So, without any further hesitation, as I said, Outlaw Posse is playing in theaters, actual movie theaters, as of today, March 1st, and it will soon be available on such streaming platforms as Apple TV, Amazon, Vudu, etc., etc., etc. And then we'll be back with a second segment from the archives, my conversation with Walter Hill, right here on Film Wax.
Sergeant Decker, we have come a long way to find you.
How about a little history? Partway through the Civil War, some of the South began hoarding gold.
The rumors about the gold is true.
Some years later, I was sent on a mission to retrieve it
with your father.
And then he disappeared.
I don't even know if my father's alive or dead. We weren't exactly on the best of terms.
Your daddy was spotted in a border town near Mexico. He's putting together a team to go after my gold.
So I'm guessing you're Mary.
Mary's stagecoach, Mary's rules.
You find your daddy, and you get your wife back.
No! Mandy! No!
Hey,
I'm gonna shoot your own son. Rumor has it you're planning a job. I need in.
You ever hear Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
You talking about them white boy bank robbers?
Ladies and gentlemen, raise your hands slow.
Butch and Sundance had two Negroes working with them, including a big white fella. White and black, in cahoots with each other.
Whatever you two geniuses are scheming up, count me in.
All right, this is a hold up. G, is that you, boy? Ain't he got a sense of humor, though?
Thank you. I see you've got your hat on, ready for the terrific. Okay, so wait. So this is like I've been doing this podcast for ages, like years and years and years, and it's great to finally have you guys on this thing. I wanted to say that right off the start. I used to chase after the patriarch guy, and that just never seemed to. I knew it was going to be tough if it happened. It didn't. I felt regret, but this makes up for it.
Good.
And very
good,
pleased. Good. Very pleased to meet you both. Yeah. And I also wanted to say to you, Mario, that years ago I worked at Sony Music. I worked there for a long time in that Sony building on Madison Avenue. Have you ever been in there?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Maybe. Have you ever been in there with your father?
It's very possible.
No, you were. Because I saw you in there in the cafeteria. In the dining room area a couple of times, and I was too chicken to walk over and say anything to you guys. But
here we are.
All right, but that was a treat to see. I think I actually did talk to your dad in the elevator one time. If memory serves correct, at least that's the way I'm going to choose to. So that's my story in the back. The other thing I wanted to say, and then we're going to get into Outlaw Posse, is that John Carroll Lynch. He's been on this dish twice. And William Apother's been on this before.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this was like a great, great opportunity, you know? Those are both amazing people and great actors. Both
very sharp guys. And that's part of what I wanted with Outlaw Posse was I wanted to have actors in the movie who you felt were credible, had heft, had gravitas. And you knew they were intelligent. You knew they were sharp. You knew they knew way more than just the role they were playing. And then when I wanted to get someone to play my son, I said, well, who's been rehearsing that for a few years and knows how to ride a horse? And that's this guy right here.
That it was great stunt casting. How many times did Mandel, how many times did you make your dad ask you? How many times did you refuse until you finally relented?
Funny word it that way. I love working with this guy.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. Not everyone gets the pleasure of working with their family. And I think working in this business is a blessing enough. But at the times we're doing it with AI, post-COVID, you got to be thankful for that. Being able to do it with your dad, that's another one. And then what we get to say with it, I think, is really special. You know, it is an entertaining film. You know, Outlaw Posse makes people laugh, makes people, you know, think, makes people, you know, you go through a lot of emotions. We got a great cast, Whoopi, Cedric the Entertainer, DC Youngfly. But in addition to all those great things, there's also some messages in there. And I think A lot of the topics we touch on, although the setting is the Old West, still very relevant today, you know. The right to vote, or even with the chief saying, close up the mountain after you take the gold out, because gold lust is bad for Mother Earth. I don't remember the exact quote, but basically global warming, like conversations we still have going on to this day. So I think with that in mind, working with Pops this time around was a lot of fun.
I like the tradition. I like the tradition that it's for a film lover. especially, you know, things that are kind of a little bit outside of the Hollywood orbit. It's nice to see what your family has been doing now. You kind of created a dynasty now. I think three generations means a dynasty. What do you think, Mario?
let's hope it's for good. You know,
yeah.
The three loves in life. You know, love what you do, love and enjoy the folks you get to do it with, and love what you say with your work. And that's an important triumphant as well. So I think, you know, someone was talking about, you know, how Chief and the Outlaws, you know, are in a way, there's almost a setting the history straight, you know, sort of component, a Robin Hood component, if you will. That
yep.
Slavery was legal. Denying women the vote was legal. Taking Native American land was legal. Jim Crow was legal. And so when the laws were unjust, then sometimes the just have to be outlaws. And I think to some degree, I've grown up in a family of cinematic outlaws, and that and I've been doing my work not with a gun, but with a camera, and saying, look, if cowboys, the name cowboys, they call black men boys instead of a derogatory term, and say, take care of get the crappy job. So take care of them horses, boy, take care of them cowboys. And so the cowboys became from that. Now, once Hollywood started to glorify cowboys, they cast them as just white guys. In fact, even the Native Americans were often played as white guys. And in those early Westerns, you saw, if you were a person of color, you're Indian, Native American, you were dead. Mexican, you're the oily bandit that doesn't need no stinking badges. If you're Asian, you're the deferential houseboy. And if you're black, you're sort of shuffling. And if you're female, you're pale and needed rescuing. But the real truth of the Wild Wild West was it was way more diverse.
We didn't know wild. That. Funny, that wasn't...
You had Stagecoach Mary, before women could vote, had her own stagecoach line going up into Montana and had her deal with the U.S. Postal Service, second person to have a deal with the U.S. Postal Service. And so Whoopi Goldberg plays her. So, and at the end of the movie, at the end of Outlaw Posse, we show the real people.
Yeah.
So it's not revisionist history. It's actually more accurate in its depiction. You know, we had Mexicans here because the border moved past them. They didn't come here. We moved over there.
We went there. Yeah.
So part of the fun of this is showing the real West more. It's still a Western. It's not a documentary, but showing the crazy diversity of it, and it winds up being the strength of this wild posse, in that, you know, they're doing things, as the sheriff's Joe Culp said, Joseph Culp, who's the son of Robert Culp from Ice.
Oh, I did not know. I didn't get that. Okay,
look at him closely. You're gonna. He looks just like Robert Culp. He says, yeah. You know. And white, robbing a bank and working in cahoots with each other. Who could have seen that coming? And so that diversity is a strength. And so the fun of it is that I'm sort of like Chief in that way, with a camera, saying, let's put this history out there. Let's create it with enough love in this gumbo that all of Americans can come. And hopefully if we build it, they'll come.
Yeah.
Have a beer, bring expectations down low, and enjoy a good old kick-ass Western.
Yeah, the film absolutely works on multiple levels. And it sounds as though you did some work in researching there, for sure. But I love that expression, cinematic gumbo. That definitely applies to Outlaw Posse. And I appreciated also when you said, like, you know, this is a, there. It's kind of, I guess you don't have to know all the context of what you're just describing to enjoy the film, which is, I guess, what you're saying. But it's really it just sort of seems more than ever important that people kind of do, you know, right about now, when a lot of history is being erased, you know, or being attempted to be erased. I'm an optimist. I feel like more of this country is forward marching than backward. But I guess I'm just, you know, we'll hope for the best that that's the case, you know. But there's an incredible quote, and I got to know if you wrote this, because you wrote the screenplay. When the laws are unjust, the just are outlaws. And I looked it up because I said, that is just really brilliant. And did you write that quote? Did you write that part, that line?
I don't remember. Things come to me, and I've got to say, sometimes things come to me and I don't know what the source is, and they come at the
well,
point, so I can't even cite it, but I don't remember seeing it anywhere.
The only thing I saw, because I looked it up, I could not doubt that you, I mean, clearly you've done a lot of homework. Clearly, this is a result of a lot of passion. It's quite obvious. But I looked up, and Thomas Jefferson said, if a law is unjust, then a man is not only right to disobey, he is obligated to do so.
Well, let me give you another one. Not Please. Only did Jefferson say that, which I didn't know that.
You may not have said that aloud to the Hemings family, but go ahead.
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah, there would be reasons for that. Sally would go, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, wait a sec. Something's...
But you know, it was Abraham Lincoln who said a version of this, which I will screw up, that he, with public opinion on your side, you can achieve anything. Without public opinion on your side, you can't achieve much. He who affects public opinion has more weight than he who makes the laws.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the business of helping to, you know, create a public zeitgeist, if you will, and culture can be healing, or it can be, you know, just like religion, it can be something that unites, or it can be something that divides. And so the way we grew up in our family, where, like, you know, we got white, black, brown, got a great gay aunt, got a Trumper aunt, we have to love with big arms. You got to love like this. And so I think that is an advantage as a filmmaker, because we know that already, even in terms of our family, good allies come in all colors. And so I think you feel that when you watch a movie like Outlaw Posse and you see a John Carroll Lynch, or the respect that even my character affords a Neil McDonough early on in the movie, and does not say, I'm going to tar you with the same brush as this other guy who's clearly way out of line. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And so you have respect for others. And appreciation, and you see the beauty in others. And that's part of the fun of making this cinematic gumbo with love.
So Mandela, tell me a little bit more about your experience on the set. Had you had experience on horses, and had you experience around, I don't know, this was, I wonder how new this is. You're on a sci-fi show right now, right? Where you play a vampire. You play a vampire, right?
Play a vampire.
So you're kind of used to stretch. So you're. I can see he's kidding.
It was a lot of fun. Once before, I did get the pleasure of working with Bob Sear. With Roots, the retelling of Roots, night two of that, I played Noah. So originally, in the original, was played by Lawrence Hilton Jacobs. But it was a great time. I had a horse then. Loved it. It's down in Louisiana, so similar to this, you really got to immerse into the setting and the wardrobe, and it was a period piece, so very, very much so teleport you to a different realm. And Outlaw Posse was kind of a similar thing, where you're in beautiful Montana with amazing stretching landscapes, and you're riding these horses that sunset going 35, I don't know how fast we're going, hauling ass though. and it gets dark, and there's no, you know, different stars, so
I know
it's really a special experience, and being out there with Pops, who was a lot of fun, and also being able to share scenes with him and play father and son, because Roots directly was behind the camera. So
not only that, but I mean, you guys, I mean, here you are, you obviously have a, if I may be so bold, it appears you have a pretty healthy relationship. And yet in the film, you know, it's not all so rosy, you know, you're estranged essentially. And so a lot of this is seeing how the love story that's actually, because every good Western has to have the love story. And it actually is between a father and a son, and how you guys learn forgiveness and learn more about it.
Yeah, we sort of thought about that Boy Named Sue song by Johnny Cash.
Mm-hmm. You know, Boy Named Sue. Yeah.
And the Mark Twain quote where he says, all my life, my father was an idiot. And at 21, I realized, you know, he was a genius, and that you sort of come and see it differently.
Yeah, right.
So discover that I'm a genius hasn't happened yet.
well, when you get, when he, yeah.
But I think one of the things that he said earlier, Mandela, was that, you know, even though our arc as father and son is not exactly what you'll see in the movie, there are things that we've had that have been challenging, so we can apply that energy. He can apply it. And there's love there that's not faked because it's real. And so and the guy can really ride a horse. Let me just say, he can ride and do his own stunts. And when I, in that scene, the bank robbery scene, I don't want to blow it for
anyone.
Yeah,
don't give it away. They're going to watch it.
Okay. But it's all one shot. There's no cuts and there's no tricks. And he comes out to rescue dad. He's got to get there and get there with his horse. And not only does he have to like me, but his horse has to like me. And
right.
A whole series of things have to go right. And they did. So it means going in with people that know what they're doing. And that was a lot of fun. There were some really good actors on this. And you
totally.
Know John, you know Whoopi knows, you know Mandela knows, you know Cedric knows. So you know that they're in there. They're bigger than their role. And then you can give them those great cinematic intros, those great Leone close-ups you come in on.
Yeah, totally. There's nods to Leone for sure, of course. I mean, and to Ford and all the, you know, opposite ends of the Western spectrum. But, you know, it's all about storytelling, right? And nuance. And it's, done. It's called...
That's a pleasure to have someone... Sometimes people come in and they don't really watch something, and you clearly do, so...
Oh.
And you wear the right shirt, which we appreciate.
Well, I told you I'm a little north of the city. It's like part of the uniform here. We have to... plaid. It's required. Well, the name of the film is called Outlaw Posse. It's actually opens in theaters, which is lovely to still be able to say that in 2024, on March 1st, which is coming right up. And I have to assume you're going to have, is it going to be at like at a Lemley or where is it playing? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's going to play. I imagine it will play there, but it's also going to, it's not just an art house film. It's a movie.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's in, we'll find out. I'll know soon, but it's going to play right. In movie theaters. So it really, it's in movie. Hopefully word of mouth people catch it and get to it.
That's the idea. That's what we're going to try to do here on, right from the Hudson Valley here in New York, where, there's a lot of film lovers and, there are a lot of, it's quite a film community up here. Actually, I wasn't so sure when I made the move a few years ago, but it's pretty creative up here. You know, and I really appreciate the time. And, you know, I feel like I always regret it because I've had on some great, great filmmakers and folks, you know, from the film industry on here over the many years. And I always regretted missing Melvin. It's a great loss. But I feel somehow at peace now with having both of you guys on. I just mean to say it's been a lot of fun and a great pleasure. And I wish you really a lot of success with Outlaw Posse.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate you, man. Thank
of
you.
Course. Let's. Thank I hope we can do it. What's that?
Yeah.
What's that? I missed that. Yeah. Well, you're cutting out. I have to hear your last come.
It's been great talking with you.
Oh, that's what I wanted to hear. That's it. I appreciate it.
What Mandela said was, we miss him too.
Yeah.
But it has been talking about him. And in that memory of that, you keep that legacy alive, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, at the end of Outlaw Posse, it says, you know, dedicated
to
badass.
That's right. The original badass himself. Yeah. And well, I could keep going, but I want to respect your time. And I really, again, appreciate now I got to reach out to John Carroll Lynch and see if he'll come back.
Oh, yeah, he will. Definitely. He was doing interviews. He's really sharp.
Oh, OK. I will. I actually think I even have his email address. So thank you, guys.
Okay, man.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I'll see you soon.
Appreciate it.
Take
have
care.
A great day.
You too. Thank you.
Like it or not, we're all Americans now.
Eat what?
Toes. That's all you're going to have left.
So I spoke to Walter Hill about this movie he had made called The Assignment back in April of 2017. And what a thrill. I mean, Walter Hill has had his hands on so many films that that I love and over the years and that had an impact on me. And so I was able to get him on here, and I thought he was a delightful guest and a great gentleman. And we met in the screening room at this hotel, the Whitby Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, as I mentioned, back in April of 2017. And as I was trying to think of another segment to play on this episode, just to flesh it out a little, this one came to mind, and I'm happy to replay it for you. Here is my conversation with the great action dramatic filmmaker, Walter Hill, right here on FilmWax. Sound great. A voice made for podcasting. Have you done podcasts before? Talking to the mic, though.
I did Mark Maron's a week ago.
Oh, that's not unusual for him to get a subject and me to get the next same week.
Well, I hope I don't say exactly the same things.
That's kind of true. Mark is more generalist in terms of his guests. So I like to think maybe I can ask a little bit more nuanced. And I don't care what he says. He's a great interviewer, don't get me wrong.
Yes, he
were
is.
You in the garage?
Yes.
Oh, wow. How was that experience for you?
It was fine.
Yeah?
Drove to Pasadena.
Oh, yeah. It's not too far.
He was very amiable, and it was a lot of fun, actually.
Oh, good. Well, I hope this is I hope this is fun as well, even though it's not in a garage. Let me just start by just saying, so you know, that I've seen a lot of your films. So when I saw that you were going to be available for The Assignment, your new film, I really jumped at it. So I can say that I've seen Hard Times on a screen. He's very impressed, I can tell.
Well, I'm pleased that you did. You mean when it came out?
No, I'm not. No, not quite. But I subsequently did. It was like cherry picked at some maybe it was a 92nd Street Y Tribeca when it used to exist. One of those things where they chose films that were one of their favorite films, and it was something I had not seen before. This is about 10 years ago, but I did see when it came out The Long Riders, because my dad took me when I was a kid to see The Long Riders. So that's another favorite because of that memory. And even then, I was so impressed. All these different sets of brothers who did the movie together. It was a real neat sort of, a nice way into the film that you had actual brothers.
It was
cast.
Kind of my way into the film in the sense that I kind of get credit for it. But the brothers that all banded together before I got into the film, Jimmy Keach and Stacy. Now, Jimmy had been in a play, kind of off-Broadway play, I believe. He had played Jesse James, and he got interested, of course, and did a lot of research. And the play ran, and Jimmy went to Stacy and said, who was, you know, going great guns with his film career. And he said, you know, we ought to do a movie where I'll play Jesse and you could play Frank. We're brothers. It's a natural.
It is.
And there was this, the younger brothers, they were around, and we could get, maybe we could get the Carradines, or well, I don't know who said what to who. But so they got in touch with the Carradines. The Carradines liked the idea. The Quaids were brought in. And then it was going to be the Bridges. We're going to play the Ford.
Oh.
We're going to be the Ford brothers.
Oh.
But that went awry. Jeff was hung up doing Michael's movie, Heaven's Gate, Michael Cimino.
Michael Cimino, for sure.
And that was a sad loss this last year.
Yes.
I have to say. And well, the problem was a little bit deeper. Beau Bridges did not like the script, so Jeff wasn't available, and Beau didn't want to do it.
So you crossed that bridge.
So we moved on, and we really thought that we were just going to have to forego the brother thing because we couldn't seem to find. And then somebody suggested the Guest Brothers.
Who?
The Guest Brothers.
The Guest Brothers.
Yeah, Chris Guest.
You mean of the A Mighty Wind and of
yeah.
like...
Yeah, that's who the Guest Brothers are the...
Who's his brother? Yeah, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, no, and they play the two guys that shoot Jesse.
Okay, so they are in the film.
They're in
it's been a few
film.
Years since I've seen it, but I remember that it's got a spectacular cast. Even all the others in the film are just it's a great cast. And the last thing I want to mention before we get to, because I do want to talk about the assignment, is, and I probably have lots of associations with your films, but because I've seen The Driver and I've seen Southern Comfort, and I just love that film. But 48 Hours in high school, went with a friend of mine in Times Square, because I grew up here in New York, coming out of the theater after seeing 48 Hours, cops running across Broadway right by the theater with their guns out on a chase on by foot. So it's like one of those bizarre events where you're thinking, am I still seeing the, am I still sort of experiencing fiction here? Because it's quite an action picture, as we know, 48 Hours. So you have a great history of making great films. But you know, you're known as an action film director. Do you consider yourself an action film director?
Well, I mean, I think I'm a director, and action films or dramatic films.
Right.
I like the phrase because it sounds neat. Action director.
It's honest.
You know?
Yes.
It's like saying you're a center fielder or a tight end or something. I mean, it's one of those heavyweight fighter or something. If somebody says, what do you do for a living? Oh, he's an action director.
Okay. Doesn't insult your
not at all.
Your sense of
it.
Of,
it is rather pejorative in old time Hollywood. It was a rather pejorative phrase because it meant you were a fellow on the back porch, shall we say, of the most of it. The front porch guys got to do serious dramas.
I see what you mean.
But I'm not. No complaints.
Would it be more comfortable if I sat across from you?
Okay. Suit yourself. You'd sit right over there.
I know. I was thinking maybe it'll be a little... So I have to crane my neck, too. And this looks like a very comfortable chair, too.
It does.
Yeah. I'm going to sit a little bit on an angle because it's kind of just on. Well, you mentioned Michael Cimino, who is one of my favorite directors as well, somewhere behind you and in my favorite pecking order. But I wanted just to... You know, I was a little unsure, even by after all I read about him and how, you know, maybe what his identity was. You know, we're in an interesting time right now in terms of sexual identity. And I know the film is really not, I'm talking about The Assignment, your latest film, which coming out in select theaters on April.
Next Friday, April 7th.
In select theaters around the country, just to make sure that people know about that. But it's not about... gender issues per se, but and also I'm not 100% sure how much I can divulge in what's considered giving too much away. Please let me know. But okay. It seems like a pretty much upfront what happens with Michelle Rodriguez's character. Is that safe to say?
Is it safe to say that what?
I just don't want to give a spoiler. Is it safe to talk
about?
She goes
through genital alteration.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And she does not go through a transgender experience.
No.
As is often misstated, I've noted.
It kind of bespeaks how people really don't understand, or we're at the beginning of trying to understand what all this is about, right?
Well, before the movie, or as the movie was being made, it was attacked in various press, and spokesmen as by its nature exploitive of the transgender movement. And I felt, rather than get into a polemical, I thought, number one, I think to attack something you have not seen is a rather weak intellectual position to start with, and it's not very conducive to back and forth dialogue and debate.
True.
Second, I by nature don't like to enter into polemical. I'm a film director and hopefully a storyteller, but I'm not a polemicist. And I thought, I was asked many times to make some statements in reply, and I did not. I said, the only thing I ever said was that the film will be my reply, and I think people will be surprised by the content. The movie does, look, number one, I don't want to run away from it. I mean, that would be dishonest as well. We do live in gender fluid times, no question about it, especially in relationship to the country I grew up in. And I think it's a good thing, by the way. I mean, I don't decry it, this is a movie. It's about revenge. It is about genital alteration. I understand why there's mistakes can be, and understanding can happen about this situation. The movie kind of comes along at a moment when all this is a big media concern.
Yeah.
Almodovar's movie a few years ago sailed right under the...
Well, it's Almodovar, yeah.
Yeah, sailed right under the...
Beneath the Skin or Under the Skin?
Yeah.
What was it called? I saw it, but I just...
Yeah,
I'm struggling to remember the name.
There have been others, and... Yeah. So I don't, it's a movie about revenge. It's about genital alteration, but the big key question about all this really is, I mean, in the understanding of the character, and this is probably, again, a little bit difficult for people that haven't seen the movie. There is a character, his name is Frank Kitchen. It's actually not his name. It's his alias that he works under. Frank Kitchen is played by Michelle Rodriguez. But Frank Kitchen is a guy. He shows up in town. He's a guy. He's a rather low fellow. He's a professional killer, and he is utterly amoral. He is a survivor of the streets and the most brutal part of the criminal underclass. He's enters into a corrupt bargain to kill somebody, but he is then double-crossed and he wakes up in a genitally altered condition. But the point being, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but the point being that Frank Kitchen wakes up a guy inside his head. He remains a guy for the entire movie.
Shouldn't the name of the movie have been called The Reassignment?
Well, it was called, actually it was called Reassignment for about 2 weeks.
Is that true?
Yeah, it was, while it was...
I'm not as clever as I like to think.
While it was being shown at Toronto, it was called Reassignment, which deepened the misunderstanding, because reassignment is a big term in transgender theory, I believe.
I understand. Yeah, yep. We're not getting into it that detail, but I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to cut you off. Trying to pick up what I think you were trying to say, that this we're not really the movie. This is about the movie and not about these other issues so much. But it's natural that it would come up, and it is very timely, even if it's because as you said, Michelle Rodriguez plays a man in the opening sequence of the film, and by using today's parlance, she the actress continues to character, the character Frank Kitchens remains a man, even though his male genitalia is removed without his...
He's unconscious when
it happens, and then remains a man, even though he has the body of a woman. And this is a really fascinating new perspective on it. Makes you kind of think about the fluidity of gender, specifically because you've given us this new dynamic, this that nobody could ever have thought. What if you woke up one morning and this was the case? This, you know, nightmare happened.
Now, I'm not presume your take over your position,
please.
But I think some of the confusion is due to the question then arises, okay, if Frank Kitchens is a guy when he shows up, and Frank Kitchens a guy inside his head all the way through the movie, and Frank Kitchens ends up a guy in the very last scene of the movie, he's without altering that portion, he grows to a heightened sensibility, but and he's a better fellow by the time he's not a saint.
Can't get much worse.
Yeah, he can't get any worse
yeah,
than he was.
Right.
And he becomes a sadder but wiser fellow by the end of the movie. But I think it's a fair question to say, Walter, if all this is true, wouldn't it have been less confusing to have cast a man as Frank Kitchens rather than casting a woman, Michelle Rodriguez?
True, but I'm not really as interested in the actor as I am the character. It almost doesn't matter to me who's playing the character, whether it's a man or a woman. I'm interested in Frank Kitchens, his experience. And
well, Walter, you've given a perfect answer to the...
All right, I'm Walter. We've switched roles,
yeah,
I see.
We're switching. Yeah.
Well, I can think of very few other directors I'd rather switch roles with than yours.
Well, I thought, I just to address it a bit, I did think, it was considered, I think I approached it from a slightly different way. You know, directors have to be at some point practical fellows and women about you get so much money and you only get so much time, and that's going to be it, and tell your story walking here, buddy. So that's the way the game is played. I felt if I cast a guy, the movie would inevitably be too much a movie about makeup, number one.
Mm-hmm.
But and makeup is time, is money, is, you know, there's a lot of factors involved there. But deeper than that, I thought it was a less artistic challenge to a person. I thought that to cast a woman and tell her she's got to play a guy all the way through, a guy inside her head who had been altered but still had a framework of a guy, to cast a woman in that part was a greater artistic challenge and gave her something to push against that would be very, you had to be very careful with the casting, but would achieve higher results, potentially higher results. And Michelle, I have to tell you, was the director's dream come true. She gives a wonderful performance. She gives a very brave performance, and she gives, I find her entirely credible. She prides herself on being kind of, you know, a tough character.
And, yeah, she's I would say.
I don't know if you've ever interviewed her, but.
No, I haven't had the pleasure.
But she's fun.
I bet.
Very smart. She's, you know, and quick. And, but she likes to shock. She likes to be crude and rude and rough around the edges and everything, which, of course, hides a very sensitive person within, but she's a great worker, and as I say, she, I think, gave a terrific performance, and I'm so pleased. I had a great cast. Sigourney did a wonderful job, kind of playing against all the heroics that she's exhibited in other films.
Tony Shalhoub,
who really is, I think, being kind of understood now as one of America's great character actors. Mm-hmm. He's been on Broadway in the last year with two really great achievements, and he's been in so many good film roles too. So,
very true. And television.
Yeah, and certainly in television. Yeah.
Yeah, I do think to corroborate. I think Michelle, you got really, really lucky or blessed with a great linchpin of an actor, and it made sense because she could embody all the complexities of that experience so well, physically and otherwise. So she was a great. That you had her was a so it's I don't question should that have been a man and then dealt with the prosthetics and the makeup. This was a great opportunity, you know, for her in an acting role and for you as a director, I think, you know, and it's the film works as a result, you know. It's great to see you back, you know, if you indeed are went anywhere to begin with, but it's just great to see a film out there with a great cast like that and you in the director's seat. Hope you've got a few more films left to.
Well, I do too.
Because there's a lot of ageism, but your work, I know that you're proud of the graphic novels and that you've been putting some of your.
Yeah, I've written two graphic novels and they've been published and they've published in France and now they're being translated, have just been translated back into English. Mm-hmm. For a while there, I always said I was the only guy that wrote books that couldn't read them, and since I don't know any French, but they were published originally in Paris. They've now been translated and are being published out of London, and it's a fun thing to do as a kind of sidelight, and it's a lot the same skills are called upon.
You're telling stories.
Telling stories, right? And trying to figure out how to do it with a combination of literary skills, dialogue skills, and visuals.
Right, so. It's a visual, almost cinematic approach, yeah. As far as all the literary disciplines, I guess you could say.
So there's that to be said. Yeah. Somehow I don't feel like just sitting around the house reading magazines.
Good.
And so I think I'm going to stay at it as long as I'm using this cane at the moment. Hurt my knee about a week ago. It's not going to be part of the permanent, I hope, anyway.
No.
But I still feel
hopefully
good.
You can break it over somebody.
Clint, I think, is 10 or 11 years older than I am, and he's still going strong.
It's great.
Which is great. Woody's still rolling along. And
yep.
There are a few
oh,
others.
Yeah, sure. I have had on a number of people well into their 80s and into their 90s, and so I agree completely with you. You can make your best films well into your 70s and 80s. So I wish you luck. You know, it's just a pleasure to talk. And I feel like, you know, 20 minutes just doesn't quite do it when you have quite the history of work that you've accomplished. But for those who want to hear that conversation, I'm afraid you're going to have to go to Marc Maron's show. But maybe we can do a part two sometime. That would be great.
I'd enjoy it, I'm sure.
That's great meeting you, Walter.
Thank you.
Can you do me a small favor? It doesn't involve anything other than what you're doing right now, which is just to say, okay, can you just say something, you know, I don't know if you did this before, but just say something like, this is Walter Hill, director of whatever. I guess the assignment would make the most sense. And you're listening to, and then my name of my show is Film Wax Radio. So it would be, this is Walter Hill, director of whatever you want to say. And you're listening to Film Wax Radio. And then I could play it once in a while.
I'm Walter Hill, the director of the film The Assignment. You're listening to Film Wax Radio. Hope you enjoy the broadcast.
One take, Walter. Thank you. It was great, though. That's nice, because it doesn't really matter, does it? Thank you. All right. Thanks, everybody. Again, this is episode number 796. We're getting closer to, of course, the big 800 coming up in only a few weeks. So stick around. Keep on tuning in. Spread the good word about what we're doing here at FilmWax. Yeah, we'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, take care of yourself and the ones you love. Have a great weekend. This is Adam Shartoff, host of FilmWax, signing off.